Hey, how's it going? Welcome to the show, guys. I'm Scott Horton. It's my show, Scott Horton Show. So there's a new Star Wars trailer came out today. The Japanese version. It's in my Twitter feed if you want to go look at it. ScottHorton.org/Twitter. No, wait. It's Twitter.com/ScottHortonShow, dummy. Twitter.com/ScottHortonShow. And, although I should make ScottHorton.org/Twitter and have it forward on, right? In case anyone makes the same dumb mistake I just made. Anyway, so yeah, man, so now there's some new pictures, new things to look at in this Star Wars trailer. It's mostly a remix of Star Wars trailers you've already seen, but yeah, there's some different stuff in it too. It's worth watching a few times at least. I watched it a lot of times. Lots of interesting stuff in it. Now, this thing at the Business Insider actually has two still shots in it that I'd never seen before that aren't from the trailer. So, you should not go look at the Business Insider thing. There's a couple of spoilers here. Well, not very spoilery, but a little bit spoilery. Couple image, not from the new trailer, but from something else. I don't know where they got them from. See, things are getting spoiled. Things are getting spoiled. I'm not going to tell you what I used to think that now I can't think anymore, because now I know more. But lame. Anyway. And of course, the wife, she never lets up, man. The whole thing to her only exists so she can try to figure it out before the damn movie comes out. So all I get all day long is endless speculation, which I appreciate the fact that, hey, I have a wife who loves Star Wars as much as me. That's nice. But for God's sake, man, I asked her nicely to stop because I don't want to have it all figured out. In fact, now I think I wish I hadn't watched the trailers at all, or maybe just the first little teaser one. But now I already got too much of it figured out myself of what's going to happen in the dang thing. And why this must be that way is the only way that explains the other thing. And what am I going to do? God dang it, Bobby. Wish it would be a month from now and hurry up. Well, whatever. Anyway, the show's about this empire, not that one. It's libertarian foreign policy mostly, which obviously means I'm against it. And I interview journalists and others, expert types. Who, you know, they know reasons why you ought to hate it too. Basically, that's the point of the show. ScottHorton.org is the website. Yesterday, Patrick Eddington had phone problems, man. So that didn't happen. Today, it's going to happen. I think. I better send off an email here and make sure, right? And then, hey, Marjorie Cohn is going to be back on the show. Good old Marjorie Cohn. She wrote a thing for Truth Dig. It's the spotlight today on antiwar.com. In fact, it's her response to the release of the drone papers by The Intercept. Drone papers revelations are a cry for ending the slaughter. Oh, and the Eddington thing, I should tell you, what it's about is, it's about the FBI cooperating, basically acting as the CIA in the Somalia war, doing renditions to Ethiopia. And it's a hell of a story, and I think you'll want to hear what he has to say about it. And he's a Cato guy, so that's okay. On Monday, we're going to have Mark Perry on to talk about the fight in the Pentagon over what to do about the Russians. Uh-oh. Warning, you're not going to choose either side in this thing, but it's interesting to hear what's going on there. Mark Perry, great Pentagon reporter. And then working on Ann Jones, getting her back on to talk about this great piece that she wrote up on Afghanistan that we're running on antiwar.com today as well. That'll be next week. So that's pretty good, right? All right. In other news, things are burning on fire. People are dying. We're going to talk a lot about the cops today. We're going to talk about the Israel lobby. You know, let's go back to George H.W. Bush. The start of the show yesterday, I told you about this story where H.W. Bush is trashing Cheney and Rumsfeld and blaming them for bringing on the neocons and listening to them. And basically doing an end run around George W. Bush to get their policies through. Which is only kind of partly true. And what's funny about it is I read a thing yesterday where it quoted him backtracking and basically contradicting himself. And it's funny, he doesn't even call him Junior or W or anything. He calls him the president. And he says, ultimately, the buck stops with the president. The decision was the president's. And so it's great. I love it. Because everything that he says is true about the quote-unquote separate government. That's Colin Powell, the Secretary of State's words, set up by Dick Cheney and Donald Rumsfeld and the Likud, the neoconservatives, Israel's fifth column inside the United States government. They're the ones that lied us into war. And it's all George W. Bush's fault. He could have asked Dick Cheney to resign, which I don't think he would have. He could have asked him publicly to resign. He could have stripped him of all authority. He could have sent him on a speech-giving tour of Africa. Isn't that some movie where they send the vice president off to Africa or something? Oh, yeah, it was that movie Dave. Get rid of the vice president. Anyway, so that's good. This is statements in George H.W. Bush's new book coming out, his memoir coming out. But then check out this one. From our old friend John Schwartz, now writing for The Intercept. George H.W. Bush was so bored by peace, he wanted to quit. I love this, man. A new biography of H.W. Bush is getting a lot of attention, this, that. But Bush, according to the account in the New York Times, quote, suffered from a post-victory despondency after the Persian Gulf War, that is Iraq War I, of 1991. A letdown over no longer being involved in such a huge endeavor. On March 13th, 1991, just 2 weeks after Iraq capitulated in the Gulf War, Mr. Bush fantasized in his diary about calling his quits, Jesus Christ, Scott Horton, about calling it quits after a single term, the Times reported. Quoting from Bush's diary, quote, subquote, quote within a quote, maybe it's the letdown after the day-to-day, 5 a.m. calls to the Situation Room, conferences every single day with defense and state, moving things, nudging things, worrying about things, phone calls to foreign leaders, trying to keep things moving forward, managing a massive project. Now it's different. Sniping, carping, bitching, predictable editorial complaints. End quote. That's right. Bush was so bored without a war to fight that he considered retiring rather than slog through another dreary day of being president of the United States. What's even more important and even more frightening is that it's not just Bush. It's most of official Washington, D.C. that finds peace unbearably dull and war the only thing that lends zest to their gray lives. He goes on to quote R.W. Apple Jr. in the New York Times, talking about how exciting it is to be in D.C. during wartime. It's at The Intercept. Check it out. Hey, y'all. Scott Horton here for Liberty.me, the great libertarian social network. They've got all the social media bells and whistles. Plus, you get your own publishing site, and there are classes, shows, books, and resources of all kinds. And I host two shows on Liberty.me. Eye on the Empire with Liberty.me's Chief Liberty Officer Jeffrey Tucker every other Tuesday. And The Future of Freedom with FFF Founder and President Jacob Hornberger every Thursday night, both at 8 Eastern. When you sign up, add me as a friend on there. scotthorton.liberty.me. Be free. Liberty.me. Hey, I'm Scott Horton here to tell you about this great new ebook by longtime Future Freedom author Scott McPherson. Freedom and Security, the Second Amendment and the Right to Keep and Bear Arms. This is the definitive principled case in favor of gun rights and against gun control. America is exceptional. Here the people come first, and we refuse to allow the state a monopoly on firearms. Our liberty depends on it. Get Scott McPherson's Freedom and Security, the Second Amendment and the Right to Keep and Bear Arms on Kindle at Amazon.com today. All right, y'all, welcome back to the show. It's my show, the Scott Horton Show. You know, if you go to Twitter and you type in the hashtag sovereign immunity, you'll find virtually all of them are me. I first learned that phrase when they let Lon Horiuchi off for shooting Vicky Weaver in the face, a sniper from the hostage rescue team under George H.W. Bush back in 1992. And the state court tried to prosecute him, and then the feds turned it to, somehow just stripped it straight out of state court and said, no, this is a civil rights matter and a federal matter. And then they dropped the charges. They said, oh, he's got sovereign immunity. We can't prosecute him. Sovereign immunity. And then, so I figured out that what that was is, that's like the claim of the old kings of England before the parliamentary system. Well, and during the first part of it, I guess. And what happened was Charles I, for example, King Charles had said, I have sovereign immunity. And then they cut his head off and they said, now you're dead. You don't have sovereign immunity. See, that was in the kingdom of merry old England, where they had the divine right of Solomon's Temple or some crap to rule over the people. They said, you do not have sovereign immunity. That was hundreds of years ago. And anyway, even the lowest meter maid basically has the right to strangle you to death right there on the street if they feel like it and get away with it no matter what. And get away with it no matter what. And guess what? They all know it too. Every last cop in America knows that no matter what, they've been told, we've got your back. Shoot who you want. Escalate as much as you can. Do what you can to try to get into a situation where then you can shoot. Where you may shoot. And it's pretty easy. Looked at me funny is basically good enough at this point. Of course, the old slogan, waistband. Oh, Your Honor, waistband. That's a great one. That's if they ever get called to account whatsoever. Anyway, so we talked about the Austin cop, who that's exactly what happened. He murdered the guy under the bridge at 34th Street in Shoal Creek. And the local DA, who, it's unimaginable that this woman is actually a prosecutor, but it's a different story there. She actually did the right thing in this case and tried to prosecute the cop for manslaughter. And a federal court ruled, nope, he was working on an FBI task force. That's that marble cake federalism they teach you about in school there. He was on an FBI task force, so he can kill anyone he wants as long as he's on the clock. That's it. He's got sovereign immunity. If it ain't de facto, it's de jure. They can kill whoever they feel like. And there's nothing any of us can do about it. It's too bad that a bunch of stupid blockheaded idiots made up the hashtag All Lives Matter as some kind of counter to Black Lives Matter, when all Black Lives Matter meant was Black Lives Matter too. And then it's supposed to be an argument. Nuh-uh, all lives do. They weren't saying only Black Lives Matter. They were pathetically insisting that their lives matter just like yours do. That's all. And I really think it's too bad because I think right now would be a perfect time for Black Lives Matter to change their slogan to All Lives Matter. Unfortunately, some stupid jerks already took that hashtag. Because they're stupid jerks. But anyway, Black Lives Matter is a very self-limiting proposal. Christopher Cantwell, the libertarian activist, something or other from New Hampshire, I saw him say on something that all they're really saying is, this isn't your problem to everyone else. And that's a huge mistake. Because what's at foot here is not racism. Well, there's some structural racism and there are racist cops. I'm not saying that. But that's not what the problem is. The problem is there's no accountability for cops that commit crimes against American civilians. There's no accountability. And the cops know it. And so they run roughshod over people. They do whatever they want. According to this commie writing in the Huffington Post, police killings surpass the worst years of lynching, capital punishment. The worst years of lynching are nothing compared to the cops gunning people down in the streets every day in this country. Every single day. Like this case where the cops all opened fire, four of them, and shot a six-year-old boy multiple times in the head and body and killed him. A six-year-old boy. They claimed they were pursuing the father, but they also claimed that he backed up into them, that he put it in reverse and was trying to attack them with his car. And then the bosses admitted that that was a lie. That never happened. They shot all through the side of the car and through the open passenger window. Not in the back. He wasn't coming at them at all. And they claimed that there was a shootout and they returned fire. No, he had no gun. They admit now that that was a lie. He had no gun. They just executed this guy. Oh, and they said, well, he had warrants. We're trying to arrest him for having warrants. He didn't have warrants. His wife says that he had a personal problem with one of these marshals. And the marshal, he was afraid of him. So he was just trying, obviously, to get his son home. Made a bad call to drive away, if it's in fact even true that he drove away at all, I guess. But then sure looks like he had reason to think he would need to protect his child from them. Look at what these animals did. And you know it as well as I do. They're not going to get in trouble for this. They're not going to be prosecuted for this. They are not going to be prosecuted for this. Oh, yeah, it's unfortunate, collateral damage, blah, 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 blah. Here's your condolence payment. We're all Afghans now, you get it? Department takes back award from cop after the video shows him just shooting a man lying face down. Then there's this one. This'll just blow you away, man. You can find on my Twitter feed, or this guy, Jeremiah Harding, linked to it on Twitter. Insanity is free is his handle. Oh, it's from the Free Thought Project. Shock video. Cop executes man as he is lying face down and complying. And yeah, got that right. She's screaming. She's freaking out. He's just laying there with his hands out. And she just shoots him twice. She's just shocking him over and over and over. And then she just shoots him and kills him. And then she's still screaming at him as he's dying. Show me your hands. They're out as far as they can be. Get down on the ground. He's already on the ground. Hey, I'll Scott Horton here for MPV Engineering. This isn't for all of you, but for high-end contractors specializing in industrial construction and end users who own and operate industrial equipment, MPV offers licensed professional consulting on chemical and mechanical engineering for your projects. Tanks, pressure vessels, piping, heat exchangers, HVAC equipment, chemical reactors for oil companies or manufacturing facilities, as well as project management support and troubleshooting for those implementing designs. MPV will get your industrial project up and running. Head over to mpvengineering.com. Hey, Al, Scott Horton here to tell you about this great new book by Michael Swanson, The War State. In The War State, Swanson examines how Presidents Truman, Eisenhower, and Kennedy both expanded and fought to limit the rise of the new national security state after World War II. If this nation is ever to live up to its creed of liberty and prosperity for everyone, we are going to have to abolish the empire. Know your enemy. Get The War State by Michael Swanson. It's available at your local bookstore or at Amazon.com in Kindle or in paperback. Just click the book in the right margin at ScottHorton.org or TheWarState.com.
Yeah, anyway, so the point is, this cop was actually charged. And then the jury acquitted her. You gotta be kidding me, man. You gotta see this thing. And you know what? You know why he was being pulled over? Inspection sticker. Officer Merkel had attempted to pull Kasich over for an expired inspection sticker. But Kasich fled to his family home where he tried to run into the backyard. That's where Merkel ended his life. This article at Free Thought Project correctly notes that Merkel seems to be in a hysterical rage as she shoots the taser into Kasich's back. He falls to the ground shouting and writhing in pain as police sirens blare. She applies the taser continuously for almost 30 seconds as he's on the ground while shouting for him to get on the ground. He is, in fact, on the ground. She shouts, "Show me your hands!" Kasich, face down in the snow, after receiving 50,000 volts of electricity, holds his hands forward and says, "I am showing you." She continues shouting, "Show me your hands," as he is showing his hands, and then fires the taser and two bullets into Kasich's back. Kasich shouts at the officer in disbelief during his last moments of life. Officer Merkel continues behaving as if the dying man is some sort of threat. In the charge of criminal homicide, the arrest affidavit stated, "At the time Officer Merkel fired both rounds from her pistol, the video clearly depicts Kasich lying on the snow, on the snow-covered lawn with his face toward the ground. Furthermore, at the time the rounds are fired, nothing can be seen in either of Kasich's hands, nor does he point or direct anything toward Officer Merkel." And so the government was like, "No way, man, we got to prosecute this one." And the jury says, "Hell no, let her go." After all, he's dead, so he doesn't care anymore, right? And she's a government employee, which means she created him, she owns him, she can kill him, his little sister, whoever she feels like, and there's nothing anybody can do about it. That's the consensus in town. That's what the neighbors believe. "Well, I was just outraged that the prosecutor would dare to indict a cop who was protecting us." She was trying to collect a tax stamp fine. You're driving around without a tax stamp. Pay me, or I'll kill you. He can't make this stuff up. Libertarians say, "Listen, there's a gun in the room. Stop pretending there's not a gun in the room. When you talk about welfare this, or regulation that, or I have a proposal for the way the ordinance ought to read, what you're talking about is the government holding a gun to people's head. And if they refuse to comply, their life is forfeit. That is what you're saying." "Well, I think if we legalize pot, that'll send the wrong message to children." "Yeah, well, I say if you keep it illegal, the cops will kill people over it. Will kill them." "Well, I think everyone should have to have their car inspected once a year." "Yeah, and if you don't have your yearly tax stamp proving that you got your car inspected, they will kill you." There's nothing saying this guy ever had a criminal record, was some violent thug. He was a homeowner. Probably registered to one political party or another. Why he went to his backyard instead of bowing down before his overlord in the first place, I guess we'll never know, because he's dead. That's the headline, thefreethoughtproject.com. Shock video, cop executes man as he is lying face down and complying. And then there's, I think I mentioned this one on the show to you, didn't I, about the rancher? Guy in a Subaru on the highway hits a bull. It's crippled. Maybe not mortally wounded, but, you know, assuming that we can all safely assume two or more broken legs, right? Terrible pain. Broken ribs or whatever. Slowly dying. Cops come. The dispatcher, it's a small town. The dispatcher calls the guy and tells him, hey, we're pretty sure it's one of your bulls got out, just got hit down on the highway. And apparently one of the cops had already shot it, but it didn't kill it. So, I don't know exactly if the 911 operator had told him, yes, go ahead and bring your rifle to go down there and kill the bull, but I think it's probably a safe assumption that they had discussed that. He was going to go down there and put down the bull. And then the only discrepancy in the reports that I've seen that make any sense are how long it took for the cops to murder the guy. Their story that somehow he picked this fight is obviously just a lie. Give me a break. Rancher goes to murder two sheriff's deputies for showing up on the scene where his bull got hit? Wrong. I don't believe that for even a moment. That's completely ridiculous. They escalated it. And in this version of the story, he was ready to shoot. He was trying to shoot his cow. And they killed him. Let's say worst case scenario, he was disobeying them. That they said, don't shoot your own cow. And he said, but it's my cow, Mr., you know, Bell Neck. And I'm very sad he's wounded and I want to put him out of his misery right now. So you can't tell me not to. And here I'm going to go ahead and point my rifle at the bull and kill it. I'm making that up. I'm totally making that up. I'm saying worst case scenario in their favor, in the cops' favor. He was disobeying them and was going to shoot his own bull. That's the best argument you could make. There's no way in the world you can get me to believe he pulled his rifle on these cops. That he was going to shoot these cops. Or that they had reason to believe for a moment he was going to shoot them. They murdered him. And they're going to get away with it, too. And the reason why is because they have sovereign immunity. They were on the clock. And so they can kill whoever they want. And you know, it's funny. When I first heard of James Bond, I still remember this when I was a little kid. When I was a little kid and I first heard of 007 and the license to kill, I asked my mom about it. And she explained to me that that's just made up. Because in England, or in America, there's no such thing as a license to kill. And the reason why is because the government doesn't have the right to kill people. So they can't license their agents to have a right to kill. They have no more right to kill than any other person does. And that is in immediate and proportionate defense of innocent life. Period. Or, okay, I guess if you're talking death penalty, that'd be different. But still, then you're talking about a conviction and an appeal and everything else. But my mom was wrong. In fact, in America, every cop has a license to murder whoever he feels like and get away with it. That's the problem. The problem is not racism. The problem is impunity in the structure of the law. That's the problem. Hey, Al Scott Horton here. It's always safe to say that one should keep at least some of your savings in precious metals as a hedge against inflation. And if this economy ever does heat back up and the banks start expanding credit, rising prices could make metals a very profitable bet. Since 1977, Robertson Roberts Brokerage Inc. has been helping people buy and sell gold, silver, platinum, and palladium, and they do it well. They're fast, reliable, and trusted for more than 35 years. And they take Bitcoin. Call Robertson Roberts at 1-800-874-9760 or stop by rrbi.co. Hey, I'll Scott Horton here. Are you a libertarian and or peacenik? Live in North America? If you want, you could hire me to come and give a speech to your group. I'm good on the terror, war, and intervention, civil liberty stuff, blaming Woodrow Wilson for everything bad in the world, Iran, central banking, political realignment, and, well, you know, everything. I can teach markets to liberals and peace to the right. Just watch me. Check out scotthorton.org/speeches for some examples and email me scott@scotthorton.org for more information. See you there.
All right. I'm Scott Horton. It's my show, the Scott Horton Show. Yeah, it's a good thing it's Friday. I could, I won't call them days off, I guess. I could use some days off. I'm not going to have days off, but. Yeah, I'm feeling a little burnout. Anyway, let's switch to from the American police state to the Israeli one. White House says time has run out for the two-state solution under the Obama administration. Well, that's just not true. He has a year and a half, and it'd be as easy as could be. All the president has to do is push, well, do everything he can by executive order, and push Congress to do the rest, to halt all aid to Israel until they close down the settlements and give up the West Bank. It doesn't belong to you. Stop stealing it. Simple as that. It's not that time has run out. It's that Obama is the agent of a foreign power. He is a co-conspirator with Benjamin Netanyahu and his government in helping them steal the West Bank and East Jerusalem. They are stealing it. He's helping them. Oh, time has run out. And we tried nothing and we're all out of ideas. The White House says it has reached the conclusion that it is unlikely to convince Israelis and Palestinians to reach a two-state solution before Obama leaves office in 14 months. The blunt assessment for the possibility of reaching a peace agreement comes as Obama prepares to meet Monday at the White House with Israeli Prime Minister Benjamin Netanyahu, months after talks at finding a peace solution brokered by John Kerry broke down and as violence between the two sides has recently intensified. Yeah, that's one way to put it. On a conference call with reporters to discuss Netanyahu's visit, administration officials say they do not expect a major breakthrough. This is really the first time since the first term of the Clinton administration where we have an administration that faces the reality where the prospect of a negotiated two-state solution is not in the cards for the time that's remaining, said Rob Malley, National Security Council Coordinator for the Middle East, North Africa, and Gulf region. That was not the case until now. He said Obama reached the conclusion that barring a major shift, the parties are not going to be in a position to negotiate a final status agreement. But he said the U.S. is still engaged in steps to prevent violence and improve conditions. Yeah. There's your hope and change. There's your politics you can believe in or whatever the crap. I admit, he's better than Hillary would have been. Sure as hell better than John McCain. But that's only because John McCain is an absolute lunatic. And Hillary Clinton, yeah, she's pretty bad, man. I don't know what's... I can't say anything good about Barack Obama. I can't identify others as worse. It's pretty easy to. But still, he sucks. And you know what? What a tough position to be in. You imagine you get a chance to be actually literally the president of the United States. And then right as you're coming into power, Benjamin Netanyahu comes back into power in Israel. Oh, man. You know, you might as well have a gigantic economic crash 2 months before you're sworn in, too. Oh, yeah, 3 months before. What a bummer. But then, see, he's the president. So,
let's see. If it was me, what I would have done is I would have given a speech calling on the people of the government, the country of Israel, to hold new elections and to get rid of this guy. He's no good. And you swallowing up the West Bank means that your government, your situation is going to cease to exist. You got two choices. One state with one man, one vote, or let the occupied territories go. And Netanyahu ain't going to do it. So elect somebody to the left of him. That's it. Or you're jeopardizing your relationship with the United States of America. Is that what you want? So saith the emperor. And if Netanyahu doesn't like it, he can suck it. Because what is he? He's the governor of New Jersey. He's nothing. And instead, what did Obama do? Got down on his belly and said, well, let me see. Maybe if I take 6 years to negotiate an Iran nuclear deal, then I'll just lay off the Palestinian issue until the very end and then do nothing on that too. And of course, he could have had his Iran nuclear deal in October of 2009, his first year in office. He could have had a nuclear swap, which would have been the first big step on a comprehensive nuclear deal. And the Israelis sponsored some Al-Qaeda terrorists in Iran called Jandala to kidnap and execute some Iranian generals, and that scotched the negotiations. But again, Obama could have just given a speech and said, listen, just because Israel hired some bin Ladenite terrorists to murder some Iranian generals, we shall not let them get in the way of the progress we're making here. Screw them. Who's Benjamin Netanyahu? He's the mayor of New Jersey. And yeah, I'm very sorry about your generals, but anyway, let's do a nuclear swap deal. They could have had the deal done in 2009. And it is to Obama's credit that they ended up getting the nuclear deal. And virtually, sort of, kind of, so far at least, and hopefully for the long term, have really taken the Iranian nuclear issue off the deal, off the table, as, you know, a fake nuclear weapons scare. Although that remains to be seen, I guess. But pretty hard to beat the most expansive inspections regime in the history of all of humanity there, beyond all reason and all historical precedent. But still, Obama has let Netanyahu walk all over him this whole time. And look how much leeway he gave Netanyahu even in the fight over the Iran deal. He pushed back just enough to get it through. Anyway, I do kind of, I hate all presidents, hate their sorry guts, but I do have sympathy for any president who's got to deal with Netanyahu, you know? When I heard that quote where Sarkozy is saying, where it's on the open microphone, and Sarkozy saying, oh God, I hate Netanyahu, that's the former president of France. And he's a right-wing neocon lunatic too, warmonger. Oh God, I hate Netanyahu. And Obama says, you think you hate him? I gotta deal with him every day. Oh, man. Can you imagine if you had to deal with Netanyahu every day? Sir Netanyahu on line three for you again. Oh, God, just kill me. I'm going golfing. I would even take up golf in that position. I hate golf as much as I hate presidents, but I might golf if it was the only way I could avoid having to talk to Benjamin Netanyahu on the phone. In fact, that could be the whole mystery of all the presidential vacations everybody's always complaining about. Netanyahu doesn't have this number. All right. Anyway. Oh, yeah, this could be bad. This is going to amount to my lousy Syria war coverage for the day. I'm sorry. PKK scraps unilateral ceasefire. Erdogan vows to liquidate them. Turkish army kills 16 PKK along the southeastern border. So I don't know about Öcalan, the leader in the island prison, or, you know, what all is the status of this and that, but it sure looks like the civil war inside. It's not really a civil war. It's sort of kind of a civil war inside Turkey
is back on again. You know, they ran this, we ran at antiwar.com this article that was at the American Conservative Magazine a couple of days ago, and it was about the demographics of Turkey and how the Kurds have many children and the Turks don't. The Alevi and the Sunni don't. Well, the Kurds are Sunnis, but they're Kurds. But anyway. And that's a lot of what has to do with the government's, you know, fear of the Kurdish crisis at all times. It was an interesting article. We're taking a look at. But anyway, I can hardly even keep score, but they're saying they're going to embed Americans with the PKK allies, the YPG, on the Syrian side of the border that Turkey has vowed to bomb if they go west of the Euphrates River. And they may also be embedding with the Arabs, too, in which case they're risking getting bombed by the Russians. In either case, they're accomplishing nothing that the Russians aren't doing anyway. Hey, y'all, Scott here for Samurai Tech Academy at MasterSamuraiTech.com. Modern appliance repair requires true technicians who can troubleshoot their high-tech electronics. If you're young and looking to make some real money, or you've been at it a while and just need to keep your skills up to date, Samurai Tech Academy teaches it all. And they'll also show you the business, how to own and run your own. Take a free sample course to see how easily you can learn appliance repair from MasterSamuraiTech.com. Use coupon code Scott Horton for 10% off any course or set of courses at MasterSamuraiTech.com. Hey, all, Scott here. If you're like me, you need coffee. Lots of it. And you probably prefer it tastes good, too. Well, let me tell you about Darren's Coffee Company at Darren'sCoffee.com. Darren Marion is a natural entrepreneur who decided to leave his corporate job and strike out on his own, making great coffee. And Darren's Coffee is now delivering right to your door. Darren gets his beans direct from farmers around the world, all specialty, premium grade, with no filler. Hey, the man just wants everyone to have a chance to taste this great coffee. Darren'sCoffee.com. Use promo code Scott and you get free shipping. Darren'sCoffee.com. All right, you guys, welcome back. I'm Scott Horton. It's my show, The Scott Horton Show. Here live on the Liberty Radio Network from noon to 2 Eastern Time on the weekdays. KPFK on Sunday mornings, except during Fun Drive, like right now. Coming up, Marjorie Cohn on the drone papers. But first, Patrick Eddington from the Cato Institute. He's the author of this very interesting piece that ran in the New York Times, believe it or not. We ran it on antiwar.com the other day as well. How the FBI can detain, render, and threaten without risk. Welcome to the show. How are you doing?
I'm great, and thanks for having me. Really appreciate it.
Oh, really happy you're here. I like this article. It starts out with a mention of a phone call from our friend Jonathan Landay, one of the greatest American newspaper reporters. What's that about?
Now, you know, when you work in a congressional office, as I did, you know, in some ways every day is the same, right? And then there are these things that come up that completely change what you're going to be doing for the next day, the next week, and in my case, for the next 2.5 months. And just as I said in the piece, you know, John calls me literally as I'm getting ready to go out the door, and he said, you know, one of your congressman's constituents is being held in an Ethiopian intelligence service prison. And I think you're, and this is where I had to kind of clean it up, I think your bleeping former employer is neck deep in this. And I went on, you know, to talk with him a little bit about, you know, what he had discovered. And he wound up running his first piece that night, which talked about this particular young man at the time, Amir Muhammad Mishal of Tinton Falls, New Jersey. And at that point, Monmouth County, in which Tinton Falls is located, was still in Congressman Holt's district. And so, you know, here we have the reporter calling us and telling us that, you know, one of our constituents is being held in a foreign intelligence prison slash jail. And our government, the executive branch, appears to at least have some knowledge of it. So that put me on the path of basically having to try to, you know, reconstruct, you know, how did he get to that part of the world? What was, you know, why was he there to begin with? And why was he being held by a foreign government? And over the course of that next 72 hours or so, I learned that, he had gone to Egypt, in late 2005 or early 2006 to visit some relatives. He's from an Egyptian American family. And, you know, they went back to see their family fairly regularly. And so he had gone there, but then he had decided, for reasons I still don't completely understand, to take a detour and a side trip over to Somalia to ostensibly offer humanitarian assistance to what was then known as the Islamic Courts Union, which was kind of the Islamist organization that was fighting, at that point, the U.S.-backed government. And in the course of all of that, you know, the U.S. government worked with the Ethiopian government and what was left of the Somali government to put together an offensive to drive the Islamic Courts Union forces out of the country, at least to the extent they could. And Mashal was among the refugees who ultimately got pushed over into Kenya. And when he crossed the border, he was, of course, detained by Kenyan authorities. And interestingly, the FBI got access to him several days, actually, before the State Department personnel did. So they started interrogating him. And as we began to kind of piece this together, it became clear that they felt that he'd gone to basically join the jihad over there. They accused him of being at al-Qaeda training camps and things of that nature. And when the State Department got to him, you know, he, of course, denied everything and you know, demanded to be deported back to the United States. And before that could happen, Kenyan authorities, and this is the part we still don't, like, have a handle on, Kenyan authorities, either on their own or at the behest of an element of the United States government, deported this guy first back to Somalia, and then he wound up getting transferred over to Ethiopia. And what I found really outrageous about it, beyond the fact that this whole rendition took place, is that they sent him to Ethiopia. He'd never even been in Ethiopia. And even the FBI never asserted that he had been in Ethiopia. So the whole thing was super sketchy. Landay wound up doing some additional stories kind of on this overall theory that he had, which I think is probably accurate, that there were a series of these kinds of operations that were being conducted in the Horn of Africa, basically with the U.S. government working with friendly local governments to detain and basically interrogate individuals they felt were trying to join the Islamic Courts Union, which later turned into al-Shabaab, or trying to join, you know, some other Islamist or Salafist-type terrorist organization. And it's an entire chapter, essentially, of this war on terror that's never really been fully investigated. But long story short, it took me and Congressman Holt about 2.5 months to finally put enough pressure on the executive branch, you know, to get this kid out of there. And by early February, I think the FBI pretty much arrived at the conclusion that the kid was telling the truth, that he had not actually been to any kind of al-Qaeda camp and so on and so forth. So this whole business of him being detained in Ethiopia and still being interrogated repeatedly by the FBI has never been satisfactorily explained. So in 2009, he contacted the ACLU, and at the time, Jonathan Hafetz, a very prominent civil rights and civil liberties attorney who was working for the ACLU at the time and is now at Seton Hall Law School, agreed to take the case, and he's been representing him ever since, and they've been trying to basically work this case through the courts. And their claim is based on a 1971 court case called Bivens versus the United States. And in that particular case, federal agents, without a warrant, raided Webster Bivens' residence and conducted searches and all the rest of that. And in the end, he was never charged with anything, so Bivens wound up suing, seeking monetary damages, essentially. And the case went all the way to the Supreme Court, and he won. And so it set this particular precedent. And what the government has been arguing in Mashal's case is that, hey, this took place on foreign soil. This involves matters of national security. The court really, you know, shouldn't be involved in this. And so far, the case has actually kind of paralleled the original Bivens case in that the district court and then the appellate court agreed with the government, but this ultimately got appealed to the Supreme Court, and that's how Bivens won. And so where we are now is that Mashal and his attorney, Jonathan Hafetz, have to basically make a decision. You know, do they want to go ahead and make that appeal to the full appellate court? And then, you know, if they wind up losing there, also appeal to the Supreme Court. And the difference, of course, today is that the composition of the Supreme Court is very different than what it was in 1971. And it's not at all clear to me, and I think to a lot of legal scholars who know a lot more about the court than I do, that the Supreme Court would necessarily even take up this case should Michal lose at the full appellate level. So that's kind of the thumbnail of the case.
All right. Well, so there's a lot to go back over there, but we're kind of at a break, so I'll try to ask you a shorter kind of a question. Do you have any idea why it is that this was the FBI and not the CIA that was running all this? Or I don't mean to acquit the CIA. If they're up to their eyeballs in it, too, that's fine. Let me know. But why was this an FBI job at all?
I think that what they've tried to do, and certainly what they did during the Bush administration, was use the FBI essentially as a means, and this is particularly true of Americans, citizens, a means of trying to shake down individuals and find out if they had an involvement. So there was still, even under the Bush administration, a fairly strong kind of law enforcement focus in terms of trying to identify individuals, you know, who either they were certain were involved in terrorism or who they thought might be involved in terrorism, and try to get at them that way. But you had a parallel track. There's no question about it. I mean, this is all during the time that the CIA Black Site program was running, Guantanamo, of course, going full steam. So you had a whole series of different tracks here.
We do know that the special forces and the CIA helped organize and really even run and participated in the Ethiopian invasion of Somalia in Christmas 2006. And that was reported from the very beginning by, I guess, the Post and the Times and officialdom.
Yeah, exactly. So there are just a huge number of unanswered questions from this whole episode. And that's why, you know, just as a practical matter, I think it's really critical that the case go forward.
Yeah. All right. Well, we're going to see if we can get back to a few of those questions here on the other side of this break with Patrick Eddington from the Cato Institute. He wrote this piece of the New York Times, how the FBI can detain, render, and threaten without risk. Hey, I'll check out the audiobook of Lou Rockwell's Fascism Versus Capitalism, narrated by me, Scott Horton, at audible.com. It's a great collection of his essays and speeches on the important tradition of liberty. From medieval history to the Ron Paul Revolution, Rockwell blasts our status enemies, profiles our greatest libertarian heroes, and prescribes the path forward in the battle against Leviathan. Fascism Versus Capitalism by Lou Rockwell for audiobook. Find it at Audible, Amazon, iTunes, or just click in the right margin of my website at scotthorton.org. You hate government? One of them libertarian types? Or maybe you just can't stand the president, gun grabbers, or warmongers? Me too. That's why I invented LibertyStickers.com. Well, Rick owns it now, and I didn't make up all of them, but still, if you're driving around and want to tell everyone else how wrong their politics are, there's only one place to go. LibertyStickers.com has got your bumper covered. Left, right, libertarian, empire, police state, founders quote, central banking. Yes, bumper stickers about central banking. Lots of them. And, well, everything that matters. LibertyStickers.com. Everyone else's stickers suck. All right, you guys, welcome back. I'm Scott Horton. It's my show and all that. Talking with Patrick Eddington from Cato. He wrote this thing in the New York Times, how the FBI can detain, render, and threaten without risk. He was working for a Democratic congressman named Holt back in 07 when our friend Jonathan Landay, the journalist formerly with McClatchy, I guess now moving over to Reuters, let him know that the government had renditioned a constituent of the congressman. And so he's been on the case ever since then, and there's a big lawsuit and all kinds of things, and well, very important America's role in Somalia, of course, as you longtime listeners know. So let's see, there's lots of things I want to ask you. I guess, first of all, do you know, Patrick, how many different people were renditioned with or without the cooperation of the FBI or CIA? I don't know if you can prove that level of this or that, but do you know how many Americans got caught up in this thing by the Kenyan and Ethiopian governments?
You know, at this point, I don't think that we do have, you know, a good solid handle on that. I wound up working this, you know, relatively narrowly from the perspective of just trying to get somebody who lived in our district, you know, out of that prison. But I do know that there were reports of other folks that got swept up in that, as well as other foreign nationals, including folks from, you know, European states, you know, NATO members and things of that nature. But there's never really been a comprehensive examination by Congress or anyone else that I know of.
How about a ballpark? You have any idea? Dozens or hundreds?
No, I really don't. And I think that what we know at this point is Michal for sure. How many others, you know, may have been swept up in this kind of thing? It's just not clear to me. I don't think that we ever really had a good accounting or a good sense. You know,
maybe none.
Exactly.
Maybe he was the only American. Is that what you're saying?
It's possible. I think one of the things that we've learned though, not just from this particular period in our history, but from previous periods in our history, is that we almost never have the full facts at the time that the events take place, and that oftentimes many years can really pass before we get a true sense of exactly how much was actually going on. Mishal is the only confirmed case that I personally know of. But what concerns me is that the other kinds of activities that the FBI may well have been engaged in, and some of the other activities that they may have asked other governments to engage in, essentially on behalf of the United States government. And that doesn't just apply to the FBI. Of course, it applies to other agencies of our government that have been engaged in the so-called war on terror. So, for example, we don't know whether or not the Bureau or other agencies like the CIA asked the Ethiopian Intelligence Service or other intelligence services in the region, you know, to kind of routinely monitor the communications of Americans who were staying in their country, for example. We just don't have a handle on that. And one of the things that we need to have is for Congress to actually, you know, take a deep interest in looking at this. And that just hasn't been the case so far. We just haven't seen that kind of interest. And
when you say in the piece that you believe, I think is the way you put it, you're under the impression, or some kind of word like that, that it was the FBI had asked the Kenyans to give them to the Ethiopians. Is that right?
Yeah, and I think part of the evidence for that is how easily and how quickly the FBI got access to Mishal wherever he was. Mm-hmm. The State Department always seemed to be days behind even finding out that Mishal was in a given country or had even been moved to another country. But because the House Foreign Affairs Committee elected not to investigate this case, the House Appropriations Committee, you know, elected not to look at this, the House Judiciary Committee, and Mr. Holt asked. I mean, he didn't just write letters. I mean, he would actually catch members on the floor and ask them, hey, you know, can you help me out here? And he never got anything like, you know, the kind of cooperation that he needed in order to be able to get to ground truth on exactly what was happening here. I mean, the best we were able to do is kind of keep up public pressure and pressure on the agencies to ultimately get the kid out of there. And he spoke to our ambassador to Ethiopia at least on a weekly basis, sometimes on a daily basis, you know, trying to get updates about what they were going to do to get the kid out of there. Mm-hmm. And the Ethiopians, you know, put up a bunch of bogus charges against him, all of which, you know, ultimately went away. But the whole thing was just so sketchy because he had never been in Ethiopia. You know, so how did the Ethiopians even really legitimately have interest, any kind of legitimate claim on him? They didn't. And that's why I'm convinced to this day that it was the FBI, possibly, you know, in coordination with other federal agencies, that were basically asking the Ethiopian government to keep him there for as long as possible in order to continue the interrogations.
Mm-hmm. And now you quote, and we're going to get to the real point of the quote here, but you quote this judge, the dissenting judge in your piece in the New York Times here, referring to these injuries that this person had suffered. And we'll get back to the court case, the legality there. But can you tell us more about these injuries? Is she talking about just the way he was transported, or was he tortured? Was he beaten?
So Mishal has claimed, and this is what's contained in the court filings in the case, that he was, in fact, physically abused by the FBI, and that he was repeatedly threatened with death and disappearance by these agents. He lost, you know, something like 80 pounds during the course of his captivity, and there were at least 30-some-odd interrogation sessions that took place. So, I mean, they were
lost
really...
80 pounds, so that could have killed him unless, you know, he really needed to lose 80 pounds.
Yeah. Right. So this is what happened to him, you know, as he has alleged, and certainly his physical condition when he got back from everything that I was told was pretty much exactly as been described in the court filing. So those are the kinds of things that we're talking about. And just
and
know,
I have a feeling
you're
going to tell me this is a guy that was not 100 pounds overweight before.
No, he definitely was not. And I think, you know, the biggest injury of all, you know, besides all this coercion and threats of disappearance and all the rest of that, which is the kind of behavior that you expect from, let's say, a Soviet Union or North Korea or an Iran or whatever, you know, like totalitarian or authoritarian states engage in this kind of practice. The injury here is the complete denial of the guy's rights. And the fact that they're able to get away with this right now, right, should be of concern to every person in this country. Mm-hmm. Because if they can get away with it here, in this particular circumstance, then it opens the floodgates for them to be able to do it, you know, to just about anybody down the line. If you happen to get caught right. overseas and they happen to decide that for whatever reason, legitimate or otherwise, that you have some kind of connection to terrorism, they can just go to a host government and say, hey, can you hold this folk, this individual for us so we can come by and interrogate them, you know, for as long as we want.
And as we've seen, some kind of connection to terrorism can mean it was imagined by a cop one time or anything, right? They don't need anything.
Yeah, I mean, and that is so true, because if you think about the case of Brandon Mayfield, the Oregon lawyer, Portland, Oregon lawyer, who was falsely implicated in the Madrid bombing, the FBI had a botched fingerprint analysis that they used to get FISA warrants to basically search his home, to put taps on all of his devices, all the rest of that. And they turned his world upside down, and at the end of the day, he had no connection to the case at all. But, you know, I mean, this is exactly how these kinds of things happen. And that's why if you don't have the strong, really probing oversight of these federal law enforcement agencies, they run amok. And I could say the same thing about Customs and Border Protection. I could say it about DEA or ATF.
Well, in fact, in the Mayfield case, I'm pretty certain, the way I remember it, the Spanish had told them that they were wrong about the fingerprint.
Yeah,
and
that's
they persisted anyway.
Yeah,
and it wasn't until the Spanish went public with it that they finally backed down. I interviewed him back then, but it's been a decade ago. But
yeah, but I mean, it's just kind of a classic example. And, you know, I mean, here you have a Muslim American, an Arab American, and a lot of folks in this country are not necessarily going to be sympathetic, you know, in that circumstance. But that doesn't matter, right? I mean, the law doesn't care, you know, whether you're a sympathetic figure or an unsympathetic figure. The entire idea of equal justice under the law is just that. I mean, everybody is supposed to be treated the same.
Yeah, and a U.S. person is any American citizen anywhere in the world. And just as well as it's any person, whether they're a citizen or not, inside U.S. borders. But you don't stop being a U.S. person just because you're in Somalia.
Yeah, that's exactly right. And that's the point that Hafetz has been making. And that was kind of the central tenet of, you know, of Bivens. And what the government here is trying to do in their argument is decouple Mishal's rights from where he happens to be located. And that's a huge reason why this case is so important. And if the government prevails, it really is going to kind of begin a kind of a new dark age in that respect.
Yeah. Well, and here, right before I let you go, let me get to this great quote of the judge here, because I think it's important the way this is the dissenting judge, unfortunately, but the way she puts it, there's real authority behind this, I think. Had Meshel suffered these injuries in the United States, there is no dispute that he could have sought redress under Bivens. And if his tormentors had been foreign officials, he could have sought a remedy under the Torture Victim Protection Act. Yet the majority has decided, they're basically carving out, end quote here, they're basically carving out a new immunity that says as long as you mix it up and you have the FBI involved and it's outside the country, then they can get away with it.
That's right. That's where this is heading, unless...
And there's no real court precedent for that. They're basically making this up brand new because they want to go along with the prosecution saying national security, national security.
That's exactly right. That's exactly right.
Amazing. Because, you know, the republic, such as it is, has been around for 230-something years here, or, well, 215-something. Oh, yeah. Since the Constitution was ratified. So it seems like they would have got around to having laws like this settled about how this works before. It's funny they would have to come up with these kind of interpretations in 2015 for the first time.
Yeah, exactly.
Hey, listen, thank you very much for coming on the show, Patrick. I really appreciate it.
Thank you, Scott. Take care.
All right, y'all. That is Patrick Eddington. He's at the Cato Institute, and he wrote this in the New York Times, how the FBI can detain, render, and threaten without risk.
Don't you get sick of the Israel lobby trying to get us into more wars in the Middle East? Or always abusing Palestinians with your tax dollars? It once seemed like the lobby would always have full-spectrum dominance on the foreign policy discussion in D.C. But those days are over. The Council for the National Interest is the America Lobby, standing up and pushing back against the Israel lobby's undue influence on Capitol Hill. Go show some support at councilforthenationalinterest.org. That's councilforthenationalinterest.org.
Hey, Al Scott here. If you've got a band, a business, a cause, or campaign, and you need stickers to help promote, check out thebumpersticker.com at thebumpersticker.com. They digitally print with solvent ink, so you get the photo quality results of digital with the strength and durability of old-style screen printing. I'm sure glad I sold thebumpersticker.com to Rick back when. He's made a hell of a great company out of it, and there are thousands of satisfied customers who agree with me, too. Let thebumpersticker.com help you get the word out. That's thebumpersticker.com at thebumpersticker.com.
All right, you guys, welcome back to the show. I'm Scott Horton. It's my show, The Scott Horton Show. Next up is Marjorie Cohn. She is a professor at the Thomas Jefferson School of Law and former president of the National Lawyers Guild, the author of quite a few books, and writing here for Truth Dig. It's the spotlight today on antiwar.com. Drone papers revelations are a cry for ending the slaughter. Marjorie's reaction to the huge scoop by The Intercept, the drone papers report, is what, about 10 stories they put together about 2 weeks ago there. It's the spotlight again. Did I mention that's the spotlight today on antiwar.com? Welcome back to the show, Marjorie. How are you?
I'm fine, Scott. Thanks for having me.
Very happy to have you here. And to give you a chance to tell the people what you think about this, I guess first and foremost, what did you learn, new factual stuff or maybe what you thought that's now been confirmed, or what do you think's important in those drone papers here?
Well, some of it we already knew, but it does confirm that Obama is violating the law, the Geneva Conventions and the UN Charter, both treaties the United States has ratified, making them part of U.S. law under the Supremacy Clause of the Constitution. And also we learned about the kill chain that decides who will be targeted. They put people on baseball cards. The source of this revelation did not want to be named because of the Obama administration's vigorous prosecution of whistleblowers. He's a member of the intelligence community, and he described this kill chain as an outrageous explosion of watch listing, of monitoring people and racking and stacking them on lists, assigning them numbers, assigning them baseball cards, assigning them death sentences without notice on a worldwide battlefield. It was, from the very first instance, wrong. And the drone papers also talk about the very high number of civilian casualties. You know, the Obama administration minimizes the civilian casualties. In fact, they've lied about civilian casualties. John Brennan, the CIA director, who used to be Obama's counterterrorism advisor, falsely claimed in 2011 that no civilians had been killed in drone strikes in nearly a year. And so you have things like in one campaign called the Operation Haymaker in Afghanistan, in a five-month period, almost 90% of the people killed in drone strikes were not the intended targets. And it also talked about although Obama has said he prefers capture, and I would rather use the word apprehension because animals are captured, people are not, but he prefers capture to killing, it turns out that that is not what the administration has been doing. In fact, Obama has only added one detainee to Guantanamo, and of course now he's trying to close it. But a 2013 study by the Pentagon's Intelligence Surveillance and Reconnaissance Task Force, which is cited in these drone papers, said that kill operations significantly reduced the intelligence available from detainees and captured material. And this task force recommended capture and interrogation rather than killing. So there are a number of things we've learned. In terms of the illegality, the United States is involved in armed conflict. An armed conflict is a term of art under international law. It's U.S. is involved in armed conflict in Iraq and Afghanistan. So the Geneva Conventions have to be applied, and they say that only combatants can be targeted, not civilians. Now, for an armed conflict, the requirements for an armed conflict under international law are an organized armed group engaging in fighting of certain intensity, command structure, rules, military training, organized acquisition of weapons and communications infrastructure. But legal scholars agree that the war against Al-Qaeda is not a, quote, armed conflict unquote, under international humanitarian law. And the U.S. is not involved in armed conflict in Pakistan, Yemen, and Somalia. And therefore, the law enforcement model must be applied to assess the legality of those actions. And that law enforcement model limits the use of lethal force to situations where there's an imminent threat to life and non-lethal measures would be inadequate. Now, in 2013, when Obama gave a speech at the National Defense University and released a fact sheet, he said that the target must pose a continuing imminent threat to U.S. persons before lethal force may be used. But not only has Obama waived that imminence requirement in Pakistan, but the drone papers say that the target need only present a threat to U.S. interest or personnel. No imminence required. And once another thing we learned from the drone papers is that once the president signs off on a target, U.S. forces have 60 days to execute the strike. And you can't say that a 60-day period meets this imminence requirement. So both in Iraq and Afghanistan, where we're involved in armed conflict, and in Pakistan, Yemen, and Somalia, where we are not involved in, quote, armed conflict, unquote, under international humanitarian law, Obama's policy of targeted killing by drones and other methods violates the law.
Mm-hmm. And now, where the New York Times had reported that before about imminence, it had been a joke, right, that they had redefined imminence to mean some other word's definition, but not imminence. But what you're telling me is that now they've just dropped that.
That's what it says in these drone papers. Yes, mm-hmm. That they've dropped imminence.
They're not just reinterpreting it. They're just
right.
They're over it. But you're saying the Geneva Conventions specify it better be imminent or you have no excuse.
No, the Geneva Conventions don't talk about imminence. They talk about that only combatants can be targeted, not civilians. But if it's not a, quote, armed conflict, unquote, under international law, which it's not in Pakistan, Yemen, and Somalia, mm-hmm. then we use the law enforcement model. And the law enforcement model requires that there be an imminent threat to life and that non-lethal measures would be inadequate.
Right.
And a spokesperson for the National Security Council told The Intercept that the guidelines that Obama he just released the fact sheet. The guidelines are still secret. But in 2013, those guidelines about continuing imminent threat are still in effect, which means that he's even violating his own guidelines.
Mm-hmm.
He's also waived the imminence threat in Pakistan. So, I mean, you know, you have a situation here, Scott, where untold numbers of civilians are being killed. And in my book, Drones and Targeted Killing, there is an essay from a person from the Bureau of Investigative Journalism out of London, which is the premier agency for documenting civilian casualties. And they talk about how the Obama administration vastly underreports the civilian casualties when they report them at all.
Well, we know it's thousands at least from, yes, Chris
right.
Woods and others.
Right. Chris mm-hmm. Woods works with the Bureau of Investigative Journalism, actually. But it's really important to have accurate counts, not just so that Americans will know that we have this illegal, immoral, and ineffective policy. I mean, it's creating more martyrs, and even our own administration says that. Michael Flynn, who is the former director of National Intelligence, he says that it makes the drones make the fallen into martyrs. They create a new reason to fight us even harder. But also, we need to have accurate civilian casualty counts for compensation for the victims and to shine a light on this very secret program. And that's why this whistleblower is what the whistleblower revealed is so important, these drone papers, mm-hmm. because it lays it all out. There are slides. People ought to go on the Intercept website and look at them. They're quite astounding. And this whistleblower, this very courageous whistleblower, joins the ranks of Edward Snowden, Chelsea Manning, John Kiriakou, and many, many others.
Yeah, absolutely. I agree with that. And, you know, something else that you kind of referred to there that's certainly in here is the normalization of this assassination program, where this is just kind of a blasé thing that they do every day after lunch or whatever, and nobody cares. It doesn't matter. The criminality goes unchecked for years on end and, you know, becomes part of who we are, such as, you know, our society is a single thing, the way people define it, you know. It's a real important
change that we've undertaken here and pretty far down the path we've already gone. So that's,
right. Let me just tell you one more thing, Scott, and that is that drone pilots, even though they operate the drones thousands of miles from their targets, many of them are getting PTSD.
Mm-hmm.
Some are refusing to fly the drones. And in September, the Air Force Times ran an historic ad paid for by 54 U.S. veterans and vets organizations urging Air Force drone operators and other military personnel to refuse orders to fly drone surveillance and attack missions. That's a really, really big thing. Mm-hmm. And this source that turned over the drone papers in The Intercept said, "We're allowing this to happen, and by we, I mean every American citizen who has access to the information now but continues to do nothing about it."
Right.
And that's why we really need to take this information to heart. Not only is it illegal and immoral, it's not even making us more safe. They're killing people rather than getting intelligence from them. They're creating martyrs when they have what is called a double tap. They drop a bomb, and then when people come in to rescue the wounded, they kill the rescuers. And then when they mourn the
like Eric Rudolph, the abortion clinic bomber.
Right. They go to the funerals and they bomb. This is our government, bombs the mourners at the funerals. And if you think that endears people to us and wins their hearts and minds and makes them not want to do us harm, then I think that you're mistaken.
Yeah. Well, in fact, David Gregory said to Leon Panetta back when he was the head of the CIA on Meet the Press, he said, you know, and I was surprised this made it to Meet the Press. Geez, you know, there are a lot of reports make it seem like every time we drop a bomb on Al-Qaeda in the Arabian Peninsula there in Yemen, that they just grow bigger and bigger. So what about that? And Panetta says, hey, look, these are the tools we have. So these are the tools we're going to continue to use, or something like that. Whatever. Job security for the CIA and more terrorism for the rest of us, I guess, Marjorie.
Yes, and enriching the defense contractors. I mean, Scott, if you really want to prevent terrorism, and you know, this whole thing about a war on terror is a misnomer. Terrorism is a tactic. It's not an enemy. You don't declare war on a tactic. But if you want to keep Americans safe, we have to assess our foreign policy and ask ourselves why we have 800 military bases in other people's countries, why we are illegally invading countries, illegally changing their regimes, killing thousands of their people, indefinitely detaining them at Guantanamo, torturing people, and uncritically supporting other countries that illegally occupy other lands. And then you realize why people want to do us harm. And until we change those policies, we're not going to be safe from terrorism. This Band-Aid work where we go in and just kill people willy-nilly is not only not going to make us safer, it's going to make us less safe.
All right, y'all. That is the great Marjorie Cohn. She is writing again at truthdig.com. She teaches law at the Thomas Jefferson School of Law in San Diego. And her article, Drone Papers Revelations, Our Cry for Ending the Slaughter, is the spotlight today on antiwar.com. Thanks again, Marjorie.
Thank you so much, Scott.
Hey, y'all. Scott Horton here for WallStreetWindow.com. Mike Swanson knows his stuff. He made a killing running his own hedge fund and always gets out of the stock market before the government-generated bubbles pop, which is, by the way, what he's doing right now, selling all his stocks and betting on gold and commodities. Sign up at WallStreetWindow.com and get real-time updates from Mike on all his market moves. It's hard to know how to protect your savings and earn a good return in an economy like this. Mike Swanson can help. Follow along on paper and see for yourself. WallStreetWindow.com.
Hey, y'all, guess what? You can now order transcripts of any interview I've done for the incredibly reasonable price of $2.50 each. Listen, finding a good transcriptionist is near impossible, but I've got one now. Just go to scotthorton.org/transcripts, enter the name and date of the interview you want written up, click the PayPal button, and I'll have it in your email in 72 hours max. You don't need a PayPal account to do this. Man, I'm really going to have to learn how to talk more good. That's scotthorton.org/transcripts.
All right, you guys. Welcome back to the show. I'm Scott Horton. It's my show, The Scott Horton Show. Yeah, that was Marjorie Cohn. She had to go. But got a great interview out of her, as always. Isn't she great?
I think so.
All right. Yeah, like I says, Mark Perry's going to do the show on Monday to talk about the split in the Pentagon, about what to do about the Russians. Oh, God. These guys, they could get us killed. I mean, I'm not betting that they're going to get us killed, but I'm saying that, you know, they might could. You know, one thing that I didn't say during the Marjorie thing, because it seemed like more just commentary than anything I could turn into a question. I think in the mind's eye, you say drone war, I think Americans picture the drone. And I think when you say drone, I mean, what does that mean? It's just a remote control plane. And I think the implication there is like, yeah, okay, I guess they're exploding people to death with them, but the explosions probably aren't that big because you can't hang bombs that are that big off the wings of a remote control plane, right? So it seems like a pinprick kind of a thing. And Hellfire missile, that might sound meaningful to people who are deeply religious, but to Americans who are not, it's just like a Tomahawk or whatever. It's just another brand name for just another product. But, you know, I don't know. If somebody says drone or, you know, drone strike or the CIA drone, this, that, whatever, and why not picture what it's like to get exploded by one from the ground's point of view for a minute? I'm thinking like the clip from the trailer of the new Star Wars, where the girl and the guy are running from the gigantic explosion because the Empire is coming and is dropping giant explosions on people. But they're killing innocent people all the time. And like I was saying, talking about it with Marjorie during the break that you couldn't hear, but it was being recorded for later if you want to hear it later at the website. David Gregory said to Leon Panetta, hey, man, maybe we're making more terrorists than we're killing there with the drone war in Yemen. And Panetta basically conceded the point and then said, but we're going to keep doing it anyway because these are the tools we have. What are we going to do? Not kill these guys when we know they're there? Even if it makes more of them, fine, we'll just kill them too. We'll just keep doing this forever, I guess. You don't even have to be exceptionally evil. You just have to be a government bureaucrat to think like Leon Panetta on that one. Well, I don't know, David, I guess. And here's the other thing about the drone war that hardly anybody ever points out, is that they smack of cowardice, the cruelty of a Hellfire missile tearing your family apart, combined with the cowardice of using the entire diameter of the planet Earth as your shield from those who would attempt to fight back. I mean, first of all, they could never shoot down a drone in a million years anyway, right? But, you know, on the off chance, I guess a F-15 could run out of gas or something. Someday it'd be possible that a pilot would be within fighting distance of the poor peasants our government is routinely bombing. It's not a fair fight, but at least there's a human risking himself to some degree there. But can you imagine, really, the constant buzz of remote control planes being controlled from the other side of the planet, constantly hunting and killing people in your town? But you never really know when or where. The buzzing never stops, though. Let's see. What would it take to turn Americans into terrorists? How about put the shoe on the other foot for about 15 seconds? Americans would be the first one to kamikaze jumbo jets into people's towers if they were treated like our government treats the people of this planet. I mean, hell, look, people are still joining up based on a kamikaze attack from 14 years ago. One big attack here. 14 years ago, people are still joining up to go fight the guys that did it.
Jeez, I can't imagine anybody on the other side thinks that way about all their numerous September 11ths that we bring them on a daily basis. And as Marjorie said, yeah, since, guess what, everybody, she didn't say it like this, since back before 9/11. It's what made it this way in the first place. That's such a unique position to take. I'm going to write a whole book about it. And I'll have the whole market to myself. Anyway. I really just want to talk about Star Wars, but I guess not. I guess I probably shouldn't. A New Zealand spy watchdog investigating the country's ties to CIA torture. Cool! I don't know if I ever knew that New Zealand was involved in the rendition program. Maybe I had heard that before. Gee, were they torturing them in New Zealand, I wonder? Or just stopping to refuel there, or what? Well, I'd ask the wife. I bet she knows. I wonder if she's ever written about New Zealand and the CIA torture thing. I don't think so. Anyway, so that's interesting. I guess we'll see what comes of that. Oh, man, I almost forgot this. Good, and I still have a couple of few minutes here. Leaked emails from pro-Clinton group reveal censorship of staff on Israel, AIPAC, pandering. Warped militarism. What a great picture of Hillary Clinton, too. Guys, you got to look at this Glenn Greenwald article just for the picture of Hillary Clinton. You've got to be kidding me. Maybe David Icke is right about all the space aliens and stuff, man, under that skin. Doesn't she look like a lizard? She looks a lot like a lizard. You must concede. Leaked emails from pro-Clinton group reveal censorship of staff on Israel. And so it's about the Center for American Progress. Of course, they keep the Think Progress blog. Remember the big fake controversy about the term Israel Firster? Well, and they the big purge of Eli Clifton and Ali Gharib and other friends of the show. Oh, yes. Eli Clifton, the notorious anti-Semite. He's got some nerve, that guy. Sorry, he's such a mild-mannered gentleman, and he's such a great journalist. His writing is so, you know, weedy, as Empty Wheel would put it. Reedy, that's it, reedy. In the reeds and the weeds, getting down into the dirt of the details and the numbers and the facts. And, anyway, how dare you not toe the Israeli party line? Young liberal activists who blog for Think Progress, for the Center for American Policy, you're gone. So what's funny, Center for American Progress. I knew I said that wrong. I got it right the first time, though. Wrong the second. Anyway, so here's what happened. Somebody leaked all these emails to Glenn Greenwald. So this is a news story. It's not a viewpoint. It's in the news section at antiwar.com today. And it's really great. It's all about how everybody better shut up about Israel. And if you say anything about Israel in your articles, you're fired. And look, here's somebody wrote an article, had Israel in it. The editor went and took Israel out of the article. Even though, that's what it was about. And then it also has the leader, the chairman or whatever her name is, of whatever the title is, of the Center for a New American Security, was saying, we got to steal all Libya's oil to make the war seem free, or else how will we get Americans to support the wars anymore? These are the leaders of the Democratic Party. This is their top think tank.